This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio. Sitting in for Libby, here is Tasha Kiridan.
Happy Tuesday to you. Were you glued to your television set like all us political nerds here in the media studio watching the king deliver the throne speech? Well, I'm sure our recovering politicians panel was doing that. So at least they got the skinny. If you did not, they will give us their take this hour on what they saw, what it all means for Canada, for our relationship with the U.S. What were the coded messages in there? Because you know there were some. We'll also talk about the upcoming session of Parliament. There'll be no official NDP, no Pierre Poilievre, and the Prime Minister says he's going to take fewer questions. What does that mean? And what is up with that slap on the presidential plane in France? Did French First Lady Brigitte Macron really smack her husband Emmanuel, or was it just horseplay, as they said? I don't know, but I will ask our politicians panel their take. And of course, we'll also welcome yours. Phone numbers here, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. We always welcome your calls on everything we talk about, including that throne speech, including that smack, including anything else you want to chat about. We're also going to be talking to other things you may have views on. Airplanes. Yeah, airplanes, and not the presidential plane, but how safe are they in the skies of Canada? It was a pilot who vented to a plane full of passengers in BC about the shortage of air traffic controllers. So we're going to get a former Air Canada executive to talk to us about just how safe it is to fly. And then rounding out the show, Royal LePage CEO Phil Soper will join us to talk about a worrisome real estate trend: retirees leaving work with mortgage debt. Are you in that cohort? And if so, what should you do? Give us a call. Let us know. We'll be talking about all that and more on Fight Back.
And now, the Recovering Politicians Panel.
All right. On the lines with us today, George Smitherman, former Liberal MPP for Toronto Centre and also former Health Minister and Deputy Premier. Sherry DeNovo, former MPP, also for the NDP here in Ontario. And Lisa Raitt, former Deputy Leader of the Conservative Party of Canada. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
All
right. Well, okay. First of all, were you all watching the throne speech? Yes. Good. Because
I saw a few minutes. I do another radio show before this. So, but the few minutes I saw, I will definitely comment on.
Okay. Because everyone's been commenting on it. We're going to do the same. I was going to ask you all, first of all, your biggest takeaway from what you did see. I know what mine is, but I'll save it for last. George, I'll start with you. Your first impressions, biggest takeaway from the throne speech today?
While the pomp and ceremony, I thought the train station looked great. I thought the king speaks pretty good French. And I think that the throne speech really was a re-articulation of what we heard. But the thing I would put a big circle around, that is a call for austerity. And the challenge for the government of living within a 2% means rather than 9% will be a very, very significant challenge for everybody in that government. I know Lisa's gone through that kind of program review model, I think, and this is really a strong signal that the bureaucracy is going to be reduced.
All right, Lisa, did that give you flashbacks? What was your biggest takeaway?
Oh, actually, two big takeaways for me. The first, I was looking, Tasha, to see what are the elements of the speech that would cause the Conservative opposition to have to vote against it, because that's going to be a crucial vote. And whether or not it'll be portrayed that the Conservatives aren't playing ball, but is there any elements in there, that kind of gotcha moment where they really can't vote in favor of it. I think there's maybe one or two. But you know what the big takeaway for me is? Was his statement that we're pivoting towards Europe for defense and there's not a mention of America when it comes to national defense. I found that to be surprising.
Yeah, he did say secure a new security partnership with the U.S., but that can mean many things. It could mean the border, for example. But yeah. Yes, he did single out Europe on defense. You're absolutely right. Sherry, what was your biggest takeaway from today?
Well, first of all, I thought that King Charles sounded very good. I mean, he's not young. I mean, he sounded good, right? But also, you know, these were tropes that we've heard before, of course, from Mark Carney. I think the kind of red flag, if there was one for me, was this cuts. And that's always concerning, obviously. If I were part of the civil service, I would be concerned. I mean, we've heard of cuts, for example, Revenue Canada. Well, I would think that's the last place you need to cut. You need to be getting taxes to pay for things. But, you know, these kinds of cuts are concerning because, just like we heard in the news before, you know, when you've got thousands of people, for example, when Hudson's Bay goes down, I mean, this is across the board, thousands of auto workers out of work. I mean, how is that going to impact our economy? It's, you know, it's the middle, that's the middle class. And so how is that circle going to be squared, or squared circle, right, by Mark Carney, of somehow helping the middle class while still cutting the middle class?
Yeah, the king said the economy is only truly strong when it serves everyone. I can't really do a
British accent. I love the accent.
Well, thank you. Very good accent. I'm trying. But it serves everyone. This kind of language, like you said, the middle class. And also, I think tradespeople will be put out of work, manufacturing sector, because of tariffs, that they're talking to people. All right. So my big takeaway from this was actually what was not in the speech. No mention of Western Canada. No mention there was a mention of Quebec, and I'm a Quebecer, so I always, my ears prick up. The French language, Quebec culture are at the heart of Canadian identity and define the country that Canadians love so much. The king said that, but nary a mention of the West. And I'm just wondering how our friends out West are looking at this.
George? There was a reference to conventional energy. It said green and conventional energy.
Yeah.
And I think that's in some way kind of a signal, at least to the Western part, about getting their resource out of the ground. But maybe it wasn't a specific reference, but I think those are words that people have come to look for.
Yeah, I agree. That was in the Liberal platform too. I guess my point was simply he singled out Quebec, which I kind of understand in some ways. Quebec is not really on board with the monarchy, but there could have been another bone or two to the significance of the West. I leave it there. But you know, the overall message he was sending here was not just to Canadians. Obviously, it was also to the U.S. Lisa, if you're in Washington right now, how do you see this throne speech? What coded stuff, what was in there that you think was designed for Trump's ears?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, because I did think about that from the point of view of Mr. Trump or somebody in his staff reading it. Mm-hmm. And I would say that you're looking at all of the project stuff, seeing whether or not it's going to go ahead. Mention of the partnership. If you're Trump, I think you're looking for a mention of him. I mean, quite frankly, isn't that him? You know, I mean, that's the kind of the acknowledgement of working with the president, blah, blah, blah. That's why I'm a little nervous about how Europe figures prominently in the defense part of it, because you don't want to set these guys on edge by any means.
Well, they'll all be together in Kananaskis they'll have little bonfires there later this June. Sherry, how do you think that Washington will see this, and does it set a good stage for that G7 event in your view?
Yeah, it is an excellent question. I love Lisa's comment. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, is Trump even listening? Maybe. You know, I'm waiting for the memes with Trump get up, you know, sort of in costume as King Charles, which will follow this. But I also wanted to say, interestingly enough, I mean, for the monarchy, I mean, you know, the Bloc Québécois, I just saw a poll this morning, the Bloc Québécois followers are more in favor of the monarchy have improved their view of the monarchy more than the other party. So there you go. And no wonder he gave a nod to Quebec because that poll was out there. Who knows what Trump will do? I mean, the hope for him, I think, always for not just us, but the world, is that there are wiser, saner voices and minds behind it. And, you know, as he throws out these tariff figures and then, you know, reels them back, what's he going to do versus what he's going to say?
Mm-hmm. That is true. Love to hear you, dear listeners, what you think, thought of the throne speech. I'll give those numbers again if you want to chime in. 416-360-0740 or 1-866-740-4740. What did you think of the throne speech? What stood out to you? Or you agree or disagree with any of our hot takes here? Love to hear it because it does set the tone. It sets the tone for the next parliament. Didn't diverge much from what the Liberals had already promised. But George, how do you think they'll be able to get this stuff done? They are technically a minority, and it is an ambitious agenda. How do you see the next session rolling out?
Well, the way I view it is that they ought to be able to find a dance partner for every initiative out of the one of the three choices that they have. And I think that's the art of governing. So we'll see if the House leader and the other folks are good at it. But I actually think they'll be successful on that point. I think that just to one of your questions before, I think, you know, Lockheed Martin and the F-35 people are probably a little concerned about the positioning in the speech. Mm-hmm. And I noted one other thing, which they committed to reduce municipal development charges in half. And it struck me as complicated. So I was looking for more detail on that. I think it's up to Carney to manage Trump at the G7 in contrast to what happened with Trudeau. So we'll all be watching for that. But obviously, I'd say he's even more volatile now than he was then. So who knows?
Yeah, we don't want a walkout. That would be the worst case scenario. Sherry, a dance partner. Well, the NDP doesn't even have party status. How is Carney going to dance with the NDP, do you think?
Well, I mean, that would have been a nice diplomatic, handshake across the aisle if they had extended party status, because that really hurts. It hurts the NDP federally in terms of the money and other things they can do when they're there. So, and the NDP also has this kind of double bind about, you know, are we going to be a dance partner for the Liberal Party? Because it certainly didn't help them in the last election, didn't help the NDP being a dance party to the Liberals. So how do we differentiate ourselves? At the same time, nobody is in the mood for another election, I don't think, anytime soon. So it's a problem. It's a problem. So I guess they're looking at the Bloc as a dance partner, which is also interesting. But yeah, as the NDP is concerned, yeah, it's not a pretty picture. It's some hard decisions to be made, and hopefully they make the right ones.
Well, interesting about the Bloc, because the speech, like I said, did include that reference to Quebec. It also included protecting institutions that are important to Quebec, CBC, Radio-Canada, agricultural producers, supply management. He even said that part in French. So, Lisa, do you think that there'll be a tango with the Bloc as opposed to with the seven members of the unofficial NDP?
I think there's just scrounging for three votes, right? Because they're at 168 now that the speaker's Liberal. Great pick by the speaker, by the way. Mr. Scarpelleggi is a wonderful human, and I think he'll do a wonderful job there. But they're at 168. They need to get to 172. They can always count on Elizabeth May. There's no question about that. So now they need to find three, and nobody wants to go to an election right now. So they may not even need to do the party thing. They may not need solidarity at a party. Maybe they just need to pick up three NDP, three blocks somewhere along the way. But the Bloc's already stated, Tasha, I believe, that they're going to support this government in the first year anyway. They said that way at the beginning. So I don't see Mr. Carney having an issue. And I would just give one observation. From watching the Prime Minister in the last couple of weeks, the more he takes control, the more in control he will be, meaning that I don't think Mark Carney is going to be argued on a political basis as to whether or not what he wants to do is is salient for political reasons. I think the more he has control, the more he is going to push through. So on the execution question you asked, George, in the past, I would have kind of rolled my eyes and said, yeah, they're making all these promises, but they're not going to do it. I believe that Mark Carney will kind of damn the torpedoes full steam ahead, govern. And as a result, his caucus may find they made a mistake not giving themselves the power to change their leader.
Well, yeah. You know,
the left may be a little upset. He's going to plow.
That is interesting that they did not choose to do that. They did not pass the Reform Act, so they can. Mark Carney is safe as leader until the next election. But I'm wondering if the Liberals, even though you're right, they only need a few votes, they will need about five, because if the Terrebonne by-election, if it does happen, if the courts do have a by-election in that riding, which the Liberals won by one vote, but as it turns out, there were six mail-in ballots that had the wrong postal code, didn't get counted, and they were block votes. If there's a by-election there, the block, it would likely take that seat. It was traditionally a block seat, which drops them down to 167. And I'm just wondering, do you think they're going to spend the summer, George, on the barbecue circuit courting floor crossers on the NDP as opposed to trying to get the party, on board for specific initiatives?
Well, firstly, I wouldn't concede Terrebonne to the block on history, because Quebec people are also strategic and they now know who the government is, and it was close. So I don't think any Liberal is going to be conceding that if it does come to a replay. I personally, and maybe I'm wrong, but I personally think it's that we're a little obsessed about it. I think they didn't stand up like the Joe Clark government and say we're going to govern as if we have a majority without any dance partners. I think the dance partners on a case-by-case basis are going to be evident, and I think actually it's going to be a nothing burger, that the government is, at least for the first year or so, going to be more than capable of advancing its agenda in the House of Commons.
Okay, Lisa, I got to ask you about the Conservatives, because I was scanning the crowd for Pierre Poilievre today, and I couldn't see him in the room. I'm assuming he wasn't there because he's not an MP and he's not the leader either. It's Andrew Scheer now. So what are they going to be doing in this session and maybe over the summer too? Because really the session's quite short that we're seeing before the summer break.
So as you may know, when the speech from the throne is read, it's read from the Senate, and MPs are actually not allowed to go in anyway. You have to stand at the bar, which is at the very back. And I think
Do they serve drinks at the bar? Is there actually a bar? Okay.
It's the bar. You can't. You know what I mean. Some days I wish there were drinks, Tasha. Trust me. The reality is that as he is a former member of parliament, he actually does have access in that area. So he can commingle and stand wherever he wants to. He has privilege in that spot as being a former member. So he could very well be inside the house. He doesn't have to lurk outside the building. So I don't know where he is, but it doesn't matter. I didn't get to see the speech from the throne, but I downloaded it and read it. So he can be able to respond to it as soon as he needs to, but he can't respond in the house, which I think is a detriment for sure.
Yeah. How's that going to go? Because, he was the most aggressive, probably the best performer in the house in terms of question period. He won't be there. And not only that, Mark Carney has said he's not going to be taking all the questions, which is a departure from how Trudeau acted. So, I'm just wondering how feisty this session of Parliament is going to be, Sherry. Do you think it's going to be diminished because of those two aspects? No Pierre and the Prime Minister, I guess, passing the baton to his ministers on things?
Well, I mean, first of all, passing the baton to his ministers, I think, is a good thing. And kind of Trudeau's demise kind of proved that that system didn't work very well. It's good for the team. It's good for team building. It's good to give them a voice because they all have to win their seats. And so I think that's a good thing. I also think the zeitgeist of the country right now, to George's point, really, is that, we almost feel like we're in a war zone. I mean, it feels like an economic version of that, where, I don't think it's a good look for any of the opposition parties actually to be hostile, especially if what Carney brings in is somehow going to help the economy deal with Trump. So there's a certain mood in Canada that, We elected this government, let them govern. And it's a very tricky, you want to be oppositional, you want to hold the government to account, that's your job. But at the same time, you don't want to seem like the cranky, the cranky other side, because nobody has time for that right now.
Yeah, Polyev has not seemed particularly cranky in the press conferences he has given since the election. In fact, his tone has changed quite a bit, George. I found he even has said that he wants the government to steal his ideas. And in the throne speech, there was some stealing, especially on things like bail reform. I noticed that they want to tighten bail for certain offenses, which is a conservative issue they brought up in the election. And he also said, Polyev did, that he would work with the government on things that the conservatives agreed with on the national interest. You presented a united front and disagree on the other stuff. So, do you take him at his word? He won't be in the Commons, but do you think that this new evolution, when he does come back, will stand?
Well, I think he's making himself more likable, and that's something that if he'd started on 6 months or a year ago, he might have won his own riding. So I think the change in temperament is well suited to the times. I think people in Canada are probably not that interested in shenanigans. I think it will be interesting to see if there's a huge contrast struck between the last session when Polyev was in and this one when he's not in, which may be, temperamentally, a little bit more somber or what have you. I think that's part and parcel of what I'd be looking out for. I do think the conservatives, and maybe Lisa would have a better insight on this, I do think of all the initiatives that are spoken about, they're really going to struggle with this liberal vision for a big agency to run housing and create modular this and that. I kind of think that one is a bit of a red flag for conservatives, and maybe they'll very aggressively hang their hat on that one. I don't really know.
Lisa?
Yeah, George, I've been looking at that as well. I mean, it's the housing crisis is a crisis, and the answer of the Carney government is to create an agency to put the responsibility on. That's okay if it works well. But my advice to the conservatives, and Tasha, you and I both know they're not taking my advice, but I would vote in favor of this throne speech and just say, when the legislation that implements this throne speech comes forward, we will scrutinize it, hold the government to account, and if we don't like it, we'll vote against it then. But for now, the speech is their path. Let them have their path, and away we go. I would just let this go and treat it as a communications exercise.
Yeah, they should listen to you. They don't listen to me either, for the record. So we're even there. All right, we're gonna switch gears in our last few minutes and talk about the slap heard around the world. It's causing a huge kerfuffle, and it's the alleged smack that Brigitte Macron, the wife of President Emmanuel Macron of France, gave him in the doorway of the presidential plane. They were touching down in Vietnam, or maybe they were leaving to go to Vietnam. I'm not sure. But he's doing a tour of South Asia, and all you saw was this hand in a red jacket as he stood in the doorway, reaching out and whacking him in the face. People have taken this to be a smack. The Élysée, the palace, says, no, it's not that. It was horseplay. They were just goofing around. They've been married a long time. Wondering how you see this, because it's when political figures do this, of course, it makes a lot of news. But, I'll start with you, Sherry. Do you think this was, did she smack him? Is this okay? Or is this really, as they said, just a goofy moment in a marriage? I don't know, in the year of Me Too.
I mean, I put my clergy hat on here. I mean, I feel so sorry. I mean, I think we probably all do on this panel. We know what it's like. I mean, you cannot control, we love our families. We are real people. We have real families. They don't necessarily, follow the same beat of the same drummer that we do because of our careers. And you just, when these moments become public, I just feel, I don't care. care what their ideologies are at this point. I just feel sorry for them, you know, because, like, you know, you can't control everybody in your family. You can't, you know, your kids will do stupid stuff. Your spouse may do inappropriate stuff. I mean, this is real life. If anything, even if it was a real slap, God knows what he did to deserve it. I mean, who cares? Who knows? And I just wish, I know it's always big news. We can't help it. We're human. But I mean, I just wish it wasn't.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering if the roles were reversed and if he had smacked her, or if it was, you know, I'm thinking Angela Merkel and her husband, there was a smack, you know, to her. I don't know. George, how do you think people would react if the roles were reversed here?
I think, you know, I do think that you're right. People would have something of a different point of view around it. But I've looked at it two or three times. You know, she was definitely laying
too,
hands
huh?
on him.
Okay.
And yeah. But I really, you know, I kind of feel sorry for them in a certain sense that, you know, they must have inordinate pressures and all of that, too. So I just hope for the best for them.
Okay. Wow. That's a very charitable here. That's two. Lisa, your take on this, the smack, as one would call it, that people are all and that people are replaying, evidently, on their phones.
It's devastating for his reputation as being a tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely devastating. It's an emasculation for sure. But how else could he handle it? I mean, I say points to him for not shoving back, right? I mean,
that would have been something.
He knew,
yeah.
Right? I mean, even before he knew the camera was rolling and his recovery was remarkable, but he looks smaller now. He looks smaller because he's getting pushed around by somebody else who thought they could lay hands on him. I think it's a real tough position. By the way, how lucky is he that Saturday Night Live has wound up their season, because they would go to town on something like this. This would be just brought up over and over again. And that's the problem when you're now the source of mockery. That's a problem for a politician, you know, and they're going to make fun of him at the G7 behind his back.
Well, that's what I was thinking, too, is that it is that sort of emasculation. I haven't seen, and maybe he has commented, Donald Trump, if he's posted something to Truth Social or X somewhere about this incident or not, because, you know, he tried to manhandle Macron, too. His handshake practically took his arm off the last time they met. So I'm wondering if that also is going to be, like you said, thrown at him when everyone gets together in Kananaskis. But we'll have to wait and see for that. I want to thank all three of you for joining us, Sherry DeNovo, George Smitherman, Lisa Raitt, our recovering politicians. May you go and recover more after today's events. There'll be lots more conversation probably around the throne speech and other things. But when we come back, we're going to talk about an issue that affects everybody, and that is air traffic control. Shortages are impacting flight safety. There are concerns both south of the border and now also up here in Canada. We'll tell you what those are, and we'll ask you, do you feel safe flying today? Phone number is 416-360-0740. Toll free 1-866-740-4740.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Tasha Kiridan.
Welcome back to the show. If you get remotely nervous on a plane, imagine how you would have felt on a recent Vancouver-Montreal flight where an Air Canada pilot vented his frustrations over air traffic controller shortages over the intercom to all the passengers. He said that the air traffic control sector, which is operated by a private company, NAV Canada, is understaffed, and sick calls had meant there was a holdup at the airport that day. He went on to accuse NAV Canada of keeping the number of new air traffic trainees low in order to keep overtime numbers high, and ask the passengers to, quote, write your MP and let them know what's going on and how it's affecting your business or your leisure plans. Wow. Okay. I would be getting off that plane so fast when it landed. I don't know how you would feel, but I'd love to hear it. 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-740-4740. With all the news about air traffic control shortages, do you feel safe flying today? Is it a concern to you? Let us know how you feel. And now let's talk to an expert to get the skinny on just why this is happening and how widespread it is. John Gradick is a faculty lecturer at McGill University in Montreal and a former executive with Air Canada. Hi, John.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Okay, so let's unpack this. First of all, I think it was highly inappropriate for the pilot to do that. It would scare a lot of people, but does he have a point?
Well, I think he's expressing frustration more than any than a safety issue per se. I think that, you know, pilots are basically following instructions from air traffic controllers, whether that's on takeoff or landing, or whether that's en route navigation. And, you know, the pilots sometimes have to wait, you know, 10, 15, 20 seconds before they're acknowledged on the radio when they want to be checking in for headings or altitude or speed. And so if they're not getting that quick response, that's when they're saying we're having a problem in terms of shortages of pilots to be able to give us the quick response that we have come accustomed to. So what's happening is that, yeah, they're, you know, the air traffic controllers are busy. There's no doubt about it. You know, is there a shortage of air traffic controllers in Canada? Yes, there is. When you look at the number of controllers that should be in place to fly the schedule that the airlines want to fly. And what's happening is that the airlines are pushing the envelope quite a bit in terms of the flights that they're planning to operate or are operating. And that's putting a stress level on the air traffic controller. So the air traffic control system is, in fact, telling the airlines, scale it back, push back your, you know, put reduce the number of flights, put controls on the number of departures and arrivals into and out of the major stations like Pearson or whether it's Montreal or Vancouver. And, you know, let us deal with the load that our staffing can, in fact, handle. For him to say, for the pilot to say that, you know, they'd rather go short on pilots, they're short on their controllers and get more overtime, I think, you know, that was uncalled for.
Yeah, NAV Canada has denied that claim. Right. They said they were not rejecting trainees to increase overtime. They said they are scaling up training operations to respond to this shortage. But they say there's a labor crunch, that they're not able to also recruit enough people to a very stressful profession. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. And I think that, you know, the latter part of your question, it is a very stressful profession. And it's not everybody who can be an air traffic controller. You and I probably won't make it.
What do you need to do? What's the criteria? What do you need to be that to do that job?
The most important element is your ability to what I call do spatial representation. When you look at a radar screen, you see everything in two dimensions. When you look outside, you see everything in three dimensions. So what these people have to be able to do is look at the data that is being shown to them on radar screens in two dimensions, and in their mind's eye, make it happen in three dimensions. And that's not trivial. That's a fairly involved task. Not everybody can do it. I've reached a certain age where I can't do that anymore, let alone deal with two dimensions. But, you know, youngsters who go into it, sometimes they have it, and sometimes they don't. And I think that, you know, whenever you have a class come into a NAVCAN course, you know, the odds are, in my data set that I've looked at, half of them will fail.
Wow. That is, well, I mean, you don't want people getting this job if they're not up to it, because it is obviously, you have the security of thousands and thousands of people literally in your hands. Is there any move to use artificial intelligence or any other tools to be able to do this, not to do the whole job, but to make it easier or to make it more efficient with the number of people that they currently have?
Yeah, of course. There are a number of tools that have been put in place to help the controllers. I'm not sure I would go to the point of saying we now have artificial intelligence assist within the controller's environment. I think we're still testing out, you know, the impact of artificial intelligence in air traffic control. It is a fast moving game that you're playing in the air, and you need as much data as you possibly can in order for you to make the best decision and the safest decision about air movement. So yes, you know, artificial intelligence does have a place within the concept of air traffic control, along with a number of other technologies. So yeah, you'll see a lot of new change in systems and in approaches and in algorithms they're using for air traffic control. But, you know, you're still going to be very much in the hands of a controller when decisions come about how do you move airplanes through that space.
Okay, I'm going to take a call here, Karen in Buffalo, New York, who's concerned about the pilots. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how you doing? Listen,
go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I used to work in a hotel, and what we used to do is we used to have rooms rented out for a lot of these pilots so they can sleep and catch up on sleep. That was one of the things my concerns was. But my other concern is their mental health, because we also had here in America pilots who were intoxicated and was trying to drive a plane. So, I mean, they must be really stressed out, like the one guy was just saying ahead of me. And I believe that, you know, they need to be looked at a little bit more carefully, because I agree, all that stress they're under, that's got to be a job nobody really wants, just like being a prison guard, I guess. But that's a tough job.
Yeah,
I know, with comparison, you know what I mean? But it's the truth if you really think about what's going on in the world and everything else, and planes crashing into houses and all this other stuff, and people who don't know how to drive or, you know, control a plane, and got all these small private planes going into, you know, neighborhoods and stuff like that. So, I mean, but yes, I agree that they are pretty stressed out. And I, you know, hopefully that they can
are.
Do something for them.
Yeah, I think they are. And you make a good point. Thank you for raising those incidents, because I think whether it's the traffic controllers or the pilots, a lot of people feel that there's a lot of stress in the air. And you've seen all these different incidents, John, that have happened lately. The planes flying into neighborhoods. Crashing into homes and cars, crashing into the river, you know, the terrible situation with the helicopter that took place in D.C. It seems to be there's a lot of this going on. And I don't know if it's just perception or reporting, but a lot of people are especially nervous in the U.S. where they say there have been cuts from the FAA, cuts to air traffic control, are the cuts causing any of these problems to happen? Could it get worse?
Well, you know, I think the big question you're asking is, could it get worse?
Yeah.
And the answer probably says, probably to me, unless we do something, it will get worse.
Hmm.
And we're stressing out pilots, we're stressing out controllers. There are shortages of controllers. And if you think Canada is short 1,000, the U.S. is short 3,000 controllers. But it takes you 2 years to train a controller. So, and you know, every time you have a threat of a service disruption in the U.S. and the budgets aren't passed, and you have, you know, these threats of government shutdowns and all kinds of stuff, training stops. And then you got to restart it once you get, you know, the appropriations back. So it's how we train controllers in the U.S., the money we allocate for it, and the methodology we use to keep controllers, you know, with the best possible equipment. You know, needs to look at. You know, you've still got air traffic controller communication that still works on copper wire.
Right.
Excuse me.
Well,
Excuse me.
There was a burnout, actually. You raised the copper wire. There was a burnout of a copper wire that deprived air traffic controllers for Newark for 90 seconds. They had a complete blank. They could not. This happened recently. One traffic controller is on, I think, stress leave. She was so stressed out by this incident, they lost contact because the air traffic controllers are not sitting in the airport and like a tower looking out the window. No. They are actually in Philadelphia. They're miles away. And that copper wire relayed the info, like you said. So is this a lesson that we've got to change the way the traffic controllers are doing their jobs, or even the location?
No, I think that, you know, in Canada, you know, my conversation with the guys at NAVCAN, you know, have been, you know, ongoing for a number of months, if not years. And, you know, they tell me that, you know, literally they have the technology to put everybody in a parking lot basement with the right technology anywhere in Canada, and they can control airspace coast to coast to coast. So we have the satellite technology. We have ground-based technologies. We have fiber. We have, you know, a lot of technology that the controller doesn't have to be, you know, outside looking up in the sky. You know, you need reliable equipment. You need high technology equipment, but you can do this job anywhere. But that's ongoing air traffic control. But if you talk about airport perimeter control, apron control, runway access, and stuff like that, yeah, you need somebody in the tower that can, you know, back up what the technology says and look out the window and say, "Whoops, we've got a problem here." But I think that when you look at you know, where is it that we're going in Canada and the U.S.? You know, there has been in the U.S. a woefully underfunded federal aviation system. And the Secretary of Transportation has admitted it, that they're about $15 billion short of investment. I think that number is, you know, is underestimated. They're close to $30 billion, and it's going to take them 4 to 5 years to get that, you know, system fixed up. So it's going to be a lot of stress, a lot of concern on the part of the traveling public, you know, over the next few years as they upgrade the system. The old system are still going to be in place.
Okay, let's take a call now from Ed in Dundas. Hi, Ed. Got about a minute here left in the segment. So what's on your mind about the air traffic control situation?
Okay, very quickly. It should never have been privatized. Transport Canada is responsible for rail, road, air, and pipelines. And they have put the responsibility on another group. And I believe the public would understand that if a heavy amount of taxes went into air traffic to make it safe, you know, but they're trying to turn it into a profit making, which is going to be a failure.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Okay, thank you for raising that. John, you know, you were an executive with Air Canada. I don't know if that switch, when the switch to NAV Canada to take air traffic control happened, or if it was always that way. Our caller says no. What are your thoughts? Should it be in the hands of a private company, or should it be the government that runs it?
NAV Canada is a non-for-profit organization. They're not in there to make money. They're in there to make sure that the costs are recovered from charges to the passenger and to the airline. They are, as far as I'm concerned, the pride of Canada around the world. Air navigation systems around the world look to NAVCAN as a model of how a non-government management system should work. And I'm very, very happy, and I'm proud of what NAVCAN has done. You know, and it's stayed off the back of the taxpayer. So it's basically user pay, and the airline industry and the airline passengers have paid for a world-class air navigation system. And we've done very well.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And thank you for all the information you provided today. I hope our listeners, I hope they feel safer, but at least we understand what's going on. And hopefully politicians and others will take the measures necessary to make sure that there is funding, whether in the U.S. or here, to make sure that our airlines and our flights are safe. John Graddick, a faculty lecturer at McGill University and former executive with Air Canada, thank you for being with us. When we come back after this short break, we're going to bring it home. That's a political slogan, I think, but we're actually going to do that. We're going to talk about your home and how you finance it and how a lot of retirees are leaving their jobs and not leaving their mortgages behind. They're bringing that debt with them into retirement. This is a new trend, a worrisome one. How do you cope with it? We'll talk about that when we get back. And if you're someone in that boat, we'd love to hear from you, how you're managing that or whether you're worried about it. 416-360-0740 or the toll-free line 1-866-740-4740.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Tasha Kiridan.
Welcome back. Nearly a third of Canadians retiring in the next 2 years say they will not have their home paid off by the time they leave their jobs. 29% plan to retire and carry a mortgage with them. And nearly half of people approaching retirement say they do not plan to downsize. So what should they do to manage that situation? And are you one of those homeowners, either retired or looking at retirement, and you still have a mortgage? 416-360-0740 is the number to call, or 1-866-740-4740. What did you decide to do? Downsize? Monetize? What solutions did you find to deal with this situation? Or are you just worried about it and you want some advice? To get some now, we're joined by Annalise Cugliari-Allegretti. She's the Director of Research and Communications at Royal LePage that just did this study. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Excellent pronunciation on my last name.
Well, thank you. I have a difficult last name too, so I always make an effort there, but thank you.
Appreciate it.
So let me ask you then, I quoted some numbers from your study, but overall, how big a change is this from the past, I guess? Have you tracked this issue? Is this a new thing? And if so, you know, what's the advice you're giving people?
Yeah, this is, I think it's an emerging trend. It's the first time that we, specifically at Royal LePage, have surveyed Canadians on this topic, but there's lots of census data from StatsCan that shows us just about 10 years ago in 2016, the percentage of senior households that were still carrying household mortgage debt was at about 14%. So we can definitely draw a corresponding line that shows a sort of accelerating trend towards more retirees and households with retiring members that are carrying more mortgage debt, specifically on their primary residence, into those retirement years. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a massive mortgage or as big a mortgage that a younger person would have. We know that about half are already have their mortgages paid off, and another 6% say, you know, it will be paid off within the next couple of years before or just as I enter retirement. So I think we can draw the assumption that, you know, these aren't enormous mortgages, but certainly it's enough. And it's something we imagine is manageable at that point, or they would be downsizing or moving on. But it's it does lend to the fact that affordability in the housing market is definitely a challenge, and not just for young people.
I was going to say, what is behind this trend? Is it just rising house prices? Because that is theoretically supposed to be good. You know, if you've got your house and the price is up, you've got more equity. Why are we people saddled with more mortgages? Did they just take it on when they, you know, could afford it with low interest rates? Is that the reason?
I think there's going to be different reasons depending on the markets and depending on obviously the household. But I think there's a good news story in here as well. The reality is that people are living longer, and they're definitely doing more. They're more active. Retirees today are certainly more active than their parents, their grandparents' generation. And so they're retiring with, I think, bold goals and ideas about what their retirement looks like. They still want to entertain. They want to maintain larger homes because they want it to be the center of where their families gather. They still want to garden. They want to, you know, pursue all the same hobbies, or maybe even more hobbies because they have more time in retirement. So they need somewhere to store all their gear, you know, skis and golf clubs, et cetera. You know, it doesn't necessarily reflect that they purchased a home that was more expensive. It could also be that they took advantage of equity that they built, refinanced their home at some point to put towards other things. So I think we can assume if you're retiring with a mortgage, you're managing to fund it. But it is definitely a different trend than what we would have seen one or two generations ago. It's certainly worth mentioning too that a lot of these households, especially in the more expensive markets in Ontario and British Columbia, are likely helping their children with their own home purchases. And that may have come at the expense of borrowing against their own homes.
Right. It's always the fault of the kids. Okay. Yeah. Let me go to our lines here. We got a few callers interested in weighing in. Fred in Hamilton, you have lived this story. Tell us about it, please.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you my story, and this is one that is one of a cautionary note, believe me. I've been retired for 18 years. Yeah, it's a long time. And I didn't really have a company pension, so we had profit sharing. I rolled that all into the stock market, and everything that I have worked, saved, has gone into the stock market all my life. So for my retirement, yes, for my retirement. Now I'm in a situation where I'm stuck into the stock market, and you know the stock market is not flourishing right now.
No.
And because of you know who in the United States has thrown a little bit of a dagger into us, and that we who are retired, we do not have any ability to increase our income. If you're being retired, you're not employable. Maybe I don't want to get into that area of it, but the fact is this. We are not getting enough money to retire, and people who are going to retire better be very careful, because when you retire, your Canada pension and your old age security is nowhere near what you're going to need. You're going to have all the expenses if you want to maintain a good level of life, and if you've got a mortgage, look out. How do you renew a mortgage when you're retired? Where are your payments going to? Boy, what term do you take? You don't know how long you take. This is going to be a really complicated set of circumstances for people to look at and see. So they better be very well prepared that this economy is not going to support them on their own.
Right. No, those are very good points, Fred. I hear you, and I think that a lot of people right now are very nervous looking at their stock portfolio. I will sympathize, empathize. I am also one of those people checking it regularly. So, yes, if you've got a mortgage and you're relying on that, that could be a problem. Let me go to Sheila in Mississauga. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. My story is similar to Fred's.
Okay.
I'm an average person without a degree. I grew up in England. We had everything going, but I wanted to come to make my son's life better here.
Mm-hmm.
We disabled our house over there. We came here, restart all over again. Okay, first we were renting. $350 for one bedroom was not wrong. But then it kept on going till it went to $1,300. I went to see somebody in the bank regarding the mortgage. I did not understand the meaning of mortgage. Okay?
Okay.
Up till now, even, I'm not clear what that means. For me, I feel like it's a chain around your neck, which is never going to go away till your death.
Well, a mortgage is, I can ask our guest to explain that. Thank you. Maybe that's a better way to do it. A mortgage is, Annalise, basically what you pay, the interest you pay to be able to finance the debt you have got to take on to buy your home, is it not?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. And it's amortized over a very long period of time. So certainly it can be a large burden. And to Fred's point, if you have to renew a mortgage at a time when you are not bringing income in, it's obviously very difficult. And in a city like Toronto, the GTA, Vancouver, in our more expensive housing markets, downsizing may not be as financially beneficial as it could be in other markets. You may not be able to find a property that's sort of suitable at that point in your life that will be that much less expensive as a larger home. So I can appreciate that that's a real challenge. And I think that our supply issues in the housing market in Canada extend beyond just first-time buyers. We know it's absolutely very difficult for young people to get into the market today. But for those who have, like your guests have just said, being paying mortgages for most of their adult life and kind of get to a point where becomes difficult to continue to support that debt, it can be very disheartening. And I think there's a need for supply across all property types, including those that will service that next generation.
If you're stuck in that situation and you do have to renew, for example, or you have to service a mortgage in your retirement, are there solutions? I'm thinking a longer amortization, monetizing your home by renting out part of it, Airbnb. Are there ways you counsel clients that they could maybe address this issue if they are stuck in that situation?
Certainly, there's a plethora of options, and you said some of them right there. You can, depending on the bylaws specific to the region where you're living, and obviously it's important to familiarize yourself depending on the province and the municipality, but there are options to make a portion of your home generate some income, which can offset your monthly expenses. Longer amortizations may or may not be an option depending on your lending institution and what your income of yours or your other possible sources of income are. But you could, in theory, put a co-signer on that loan that does have a steady income so that the bank would be secured by another person's income. And of course, downsizing is an option. Another option is a reverse mortgage. This isn't the perfect solution for everyone, but it is an option in Canada that some people do choose to explore at a certain point so that they can stay in the comfort of their own home. And you can't discredit the value of that. You've spent so many years building up your community and your kind of sense of self in a certain place, and you may not want to leave that space. So different people will get creative with different financial options.
Those are all very good ideas, and I wish I could take more of the calls. I will say we'll probably revisit this issue on Friday. If you want to call back in, I see you there. I'm so sorry we are out of time, but we will definitely, this is hitting a nerve. I want to thank you, Annalise Cugliari-Allegretti, Director of Research and Communications at Royal LePage, for joining us on the show today. It's been a pleasure hosting, and I will see you all again tomorrow. Have a great afternoon.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.